Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lien, and I'm a fourth-year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin, I'm a family practice resident at UBC. So, we're revisiting the topic of dyslipidemia, and we're covering the AHA guideline published in November of 2013 on the treatment of dyslipidemia in adults in reducing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk. We'll also highlight the key differences between the new AHA guideline and the Canadian Cardiovascular Society guideline on dyslipidemia. For listeners who haven't had a chance to listen to the previous episodes on the CCS guidelines on the treatment of dyslipidemia, they're still available on iTunes, and they'll always be available on our website, fppodcast.org. The AHA guideline identified four major statin benefit groups for which statin therapy should be initiated, and these are, number one, individuals with clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, for whom treatment with statin therapy will be considered secondary prevention. And clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease include acute coronary syndromes, a history of MI, stable or unstable angina, coronary or other arterial revascularization, stroke, TIA, peripheral arterial disease, which are presumed to be of atherosclerotic origin. The second major statin benefit group are those with elevated LDL cholesterol greater than 190 milligrams per deciliter or 4.9 millimoles per liter. The third group are individuals with diabetes who are between 40 to 75 years of age with an LDL of 70 to 189 and without clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and converted to standard international units that will be between 1.8 and 4.9 millimoles per liter. The fourth group of individuals are those who does not satisfy the first three criteria, but have an estimated 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk of greater than 7.5%. And this 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk should be estimated using the pooled cohort equations based on the following factors: age, sex, race, total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, systolic blood pressure, antihypertensive use, diabetes status, and smoking status. As you may have noticed, this disease calculator is quite similar to the Framingham risk score that CCS uses. For each major statin benefit groups, there is a recommended level of statin therapy that the patient should undertake. So for group 1, those with clinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, if the patient is less than or equal to 75 years of age, recommendation is to start high-intensity statin. And if they are greater than 75 years of age, or if they're not a candidate for high-intensity statin, then they should get moderate-intensity statin. And for group 2, those with LDL of greater than 4.9 millimoles per liter, they should be on high-intensity statins. For patients who have diabetes, either type 1 or type 2, between ages of 40 to 75, then they should be on moderate-intensity statin. And additionally, if their estimated 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk is greater than or equal to 7.5%, then they could be considered for high-intensity statin. Now, finally, for group 4, and these are the patients without history of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, whose LDL is not greater than 4.9 millimoles per liter, and those without diabetes. And their estimated 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk is greater than 7.5%, then they should be on moderate to high intensity statin. For patients who do not fall into these four major statin benefit groups, use of statin to prevent atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is less clear. However, the AHA guideline does list some additional factors that could be considered, which would influence atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk. And these additional risk factors should be balanced against adverse effects, drug-drug interactions, and the patient's preference. We'll go over the additional risk factors and additional tests a little bit later. So right away, you may have noticed that some differences between the CCS guideline and the new AHA guideline. The CCS guideline starts with a Framingham risk calculation, and then separates patients into low-risk, intermediate-risk, and high-risk categories. Just to review, the low-risk group in CCS guideline means the Framingham risk score of less than 10%, the intermediate risk is between 10 and 19%, and the high-risk group is greater than or equal to 20%, or with clinical vascular disease, abdominal aortic aneurysm, diabetes and age greater than 40 years, or diabetes for more than 15 years of disease duration and age greater than 30 years, or evidence of microvascular disease with diabetes, or chronic kidney disease, or high-risk hypertension. And at any point, if the LDO is greater than or equal to 5 millimoles per liter, the CCS guideline also recommends starting a statin therapy. And the AHA guideline is different because if the patient has a history or clinical evidence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, then there is really no need to calculate a Framingham risk score. Likewise, if the patient's LDO is greater than 4.9 millimoles per liter or 190 milligrams per deciliter, there's also no reason to calculate the risk score again, because these patients should be considered for statin therapy based on an evidence of reduced risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Also, for diabetic patients age greater than 40, the AHA guideline states that they should be at least on a moderate intensity statin, and if the 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk is greater than 7.5%, then they should be put on high-intensity statin. The AHA guideline provides a table of high, moderate, and low-intensity statin therapy. For high-intensity statin therapy, they recommend atorvastatin 40 to 80 milligrams or rosuvastatin 20 to 40 milligrams. For moderate-intensity statin, they listed quite a number of statins, but for atorvastatin, it's 10 to 20 milligrams, and rosuvastatin is 5 to 10 milligrams. And for low-intensity statin therapy, which is not really recommended by the guideline at any point, they listed lovastatin 20 milligrams or pravastatin 10 to 20 milligrams. Also, simvastatin 10 milligrams is also considered a low-intensity statin therapy. As you may remember, simvastatin at 80 milligram dose is no longer recommended, as Tina mentioned in our previous coverage on dyslipidemia and statin therapy. Another major difference between the AHA guideline and the CCS guideline is the threshold for statin treatment based on the 10-year cardiovascular disease risk. In the CCS guideline, patients in the low-risk category with a Framingham risk score of less than 10%, 10-year cardiovascular disease risk, and the LDL of less than 5 millimoles per liter, the patient could avoid statin therapy. Even in the intermediate disease risk, with a Framingham risk score of 10 to 19%, if the patient has an LDL of less than 3.5 millimoles per liter, the CCS guideline says they could consider behavioral modification and no statin therapy. Contrast that with the AHA guideline's stricter rule about recommending statin therapy to patients with greater than or equal to 7.5% 10-year cardiovascular disease risk. And this is a major point of criticism of the AHA guideline because the lowered threshold of cardiovascular disease risk to 7.5% means that a lot more patients will be recommended to start statin therapy. Another major difference between the CCS guideline and the AHA guideline is the target of statin therapy. The CCS guideline sets a primary target of LDL cholesterol for the high risk and the intermediate risk group to less than or equal to 2 millimoles per liter of LDL cholesterol or greater than or equal to 50% reduction. And for the low risk group, they recommend greater than or equal to 50% reduction in LDL cholesterol. They also recommended some alternate targets of ApoB less than or equal to 0.8 grams per liter or non-HDL cholesterol less than or equal to 2.6 millimoles per liter. And this is for the high risk and the intermediate disease risk groups. And this is in stark contrast to the new AHA guideline. They pointed out that the available clinical trial data are mostly based on fixed dose statin therapies, and there is absence of data that supports treatment targets. In other words, there is no data on the magnitude of additional cardiovascular disease risk reduction leading to a lowered patient-centered outcome. Besides, The non-statin therapies, although they can reduce LDL cholesterol, they're not shown to improve cardiovascular disease outcome. Therefore, if the goal of statin therapy is to treat to target, then clinicians might be inclined to add a non-statin therapy to further lower the LDL, which is against best evidence. On the other hand, for patients who does achieve a target of LDL less than 2 millimoles per liter, by a lower dose or a moderate dose of statin therapy, the CCS guideline may say that that's enough treatment because they're at target, even though there's clinical data that showed higher dose of statin may further increase the reduction in cardiovascular disease risk. For these reasons, the new AHA guideline supports using either a moderate intensity statin or a high intensity statin based on the patient's characteristic, and then staying with that dose unless the patient has some adverse effects. And they completely abolished the notion of using statin therapy to treat to a specific target for LDL. Although they did say that clinicians may consider using LDL level to monitor adherence or response to medications. Now, the AHA guideline does have some further details about statin therapy. So let's go over the initiation of statin therapy. Prior to starting statins, the recommended blood work includes fasting lipid panel, ALT, hemoglobin A1C if the diabetes is not diagnosed yet, and if indicated, creatine kinase, and of course, evaluation of other possible secondary causes of dyslipidemia. If from this evaluation, their triglyceride level is found to be significantly elevated to greater than or equal to 500 milligrams per deciliter, which is 5.6 millimoles per liter, or if the LDL cholesterol is greater than 190 milligrams per deciliter, or 4.9 millimoles per liter, then we need to consider secondary causes of dyslipidemia. Particularly, we need to screen them for familial hyperlipidemia. If their liver enzyme is elevated to greater than 3 times upper limit of normal, then we need to evaluate further. After the initial evaluation, we'll assign the patients to each major statin benefit group and then treat according to the guideline using moderate or high intensity statin. Of course, this has to be done after a discussion with the patient about the atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk and the level of reduction by the statins that the patient could expect, as well as the adverse effect of statins, drug-drug interactions of statins with other medications, and the patient's preferences. Now, after initiation of statin therapy, their statin therapy should be continuously monitored. To monitor statin therapy, a fasting lipid panel could be considered to assess adherence. The expected reduction in LDL with a high-intensity statin therapy is greater than 50% from the baseline, and the moderate-intensity statin is expected to reduce LDL by approximately 30 to 50%. So if the patient does not achieve the expected reduction in LDL, then it should be considered whether or not they have intolerance to statin therapy. And if they do have side effects from statins, and most commonly these would be muscle symptoms including pain, tenderness, stiffness, cramping, weakness, or fatigue, then the statin therapy should be discontinued and the muscle symptoms be reevaluated. If the symptoms are severe, then creatine kinase, creatinine, and urinalysis for myoglobinuria should be ordered. Now, if the symptoms are mild to moderate, and if the symptoms resolve after discontinuation of statins, then it's reasonable to slowly put them back on statins at a lower dose and establish a causal relationship between the muscle symptoms and statin therapy. If a low dose of statin is tolerated, then the guideline recommends gradually increase the dose as tolerated. However, if after the discontinuation of statins, the symptoms of muscle pain does not resolve within 2 months, then we need to consider other causes of muscle symptoms. And these could include hypothyroidism, reduced renal or hepatic function, rheumatologic disorders such as polymyalgia rheumatica, steroid myopathy, vitamin D deficiency, or primary muscle diseases. If the muscle symptoms are thought not to be due to statins, or if the underlying disease has been managed, then resuming statin therapy could be recommended. The AHA guideline also provided a summary of statin therapy recommendations. They identified several risk factors that predisposes individuals to statin adverse effects. And these include multiple comorbidities, including impaired renal or hepatic function, history of previous statin intolerance or muscle disorders, unexplained elevations of ALT to greater than 3 times of upper limits of normal, or concomitant use of drugs that interacts with statins, or patients age greater than 75 years, or history of hemorrhagic stroke and Asian ancestry. If you believe the individual is at a high risk for developing statin myopathy, then the baseline CK level is reasonable, but it's not routinely recommended. And for individuals presenting with a confusional state or memory impairment, we should evaluate the patient for non-statin causes such as other medications, other systemic and neuropsychiatric causes, and consider the possibility of adverse effects associated with statin drug therapy. Although, in our next episode on the EBM on dyslipidemia, I'll present some evidence on whether or not statins can cause memory impairment. The AHA guideline also mentioned a few additional tests and factors that could be considered if the patient does not fall into one of the 4 major statin benefit groups. For patients who do not meet the criteria for one of the 4 statin major benefit groups, for whom you think statin therapy might still be considered, you can consider the following factors. Number 1 is a very elevated LDL to greater than or equal to 4.1 millimoles per liter, or evidence of genetic hyperlipidemias such as family history of premature atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease with the onset of less than 55 years of age in the first degree male relative or less than 65 years of age in the first degree female relative. Some blood tests could include high sensitivity CRP and a level of 2 milligrams per liter, and coronary artery calcium of greater than 75 percentile for age, sex, and ethnicity, or ankle brachial index of less than 0.9, or an elevated lifetime risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. The CCS guideline also recommends high sensitivity CRP, coronary artery calcium, ankle brachial index, and consideration of family history. Although the CCS guideline also mentions a few other additional tests that the AHA does not directly endorse. So, to summarize, the AHA guideline published in November 2013 has several major differences when compared to the CCS guideline covered in our previous podcast episode based on the CCS guideline on dyslipidemia published in 2012. The first major difference is that the AHA guideline broadens the threshold for treating a patient with statin therapy, and they lowered the 10-year cardiovascular disease risk down to 7.5%, above which the guideline recommends consideration of at least a moderate level of statin therapy. And this is very different from the CCS guideline, which recommends for patients at a low risk with an LDL of less than 5 millimoles per liter to consider just lifestyle modification. Although for a Framingham risk score between 9 and 5%, they could also consider optional secondary testing, after which if it indicates a higher risk, then they may consider statin therapy. And even for patients in the intermediate risk group of risk of 10 to 19%, the patient could still avoid statin therapy if their LDL is less than 3.5 millimoles per liter. And another major difference between AHA and the CCS guideline is that the AHA guideline does not recommend using statin to treat to a specific LDL target. Instead, once you identify someone as being in the major statin benefit group, the recommendation is to follow the guideline and choose either a high-intensity statin or a moderate-intensity statin for this patient. Now, we could use fasting lipid panels to follow the patient's adherence and monitor for reasons of non-adherence. Although I suspect if we build a good report, we can just ask the patient if they're taking the medications or not, and if they have any side effects. But anyway, that is a very major paradigm shift from the CCS guideline, which still recommends treatment of statins to specific LDL targets. Now, finally, As Dr. James McCormack of UBC likes to point out, the new AHA guideline used the phrase patient preference 20 times in their guideline. This emphasizes the importance of engaging the patient in the discussion about cardiovascular disease risk, the amount of risk reduction that they can expect to achieve with a statin therapy, and the risk of adverse effects of statin therapy, and hopefully have a rational discussion about these important topics and arrive at a patient-centered, evidence-based decision about using statin as a therapy to reduce cardiovascular disease risk. Further, he offered a very simple approach to this discussion with a patient, and basically, he pointed out that statins reduce heart attack and stroke risk by approximately 30% relative risk for almost all different patient groups. So if the baseline risk is 7.5%, then the absolute risk reduction will be 2.5%, and that's across 10 years of statin therapy. Now, if the patient has a very high risk, such as 30% as a secondary prevention, their expected reduction in risk with a statin therapy is 1/3 of 30%, which is 10% absolute risk reduction. So treatment with statin for 10 years for this high-risk patient group has a 1 in 10 chance of benefiting the patient. I'll put a link to an easy-to-read article by Dr. McCormack on Kevin MD that goes over the notions of risk reduction, patient preference, and true spirit of evidence-based medicine. And that brings us to the end of this episode. As always, we would love to hear your feedback on our website at fppodcast.org, and we'll again ask you guys to go to iTunes and give us a rating if you like what you heard today. For our next episode, we plan to present on more evidence-based medicine on the treatment of dyslipidemia, because even the new AHA guideline has some controversies when cross-examined with evidence-based medicine. So until then, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.